Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. A diplomatic row between China and Japan isn't going away. The U.S. peace plan for Gaza leaves Palestinians on the outside. And the Saudi leader visits Trump. Normalization with Israel is out, but business deals are in. First, a diplomatic row between China and Japan isn't going away. The new Japanese Prime Minister, Takaichi Sanai, said that Japan might take military action to defend Taiwan from a Chinese attack in a, quote, survival-threatening situation. That remark provoked the Chinese consul in Osaka to warn that the dirty neck that sticks itself in must be cut off. In other words, Japan should not interfere in what China considers its internal affairs. The Japanese government responded that the consul's remark was inappropriate and that Beijing should take appropriate action. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman made the usual pronouncement that Taiwan is a Chinese affair and no one should interfere in it. He added, quote, "Where exactly does Japan want to take its relations with China?" Beijing defended its consul's remark as a response to wrongful and dangerous Japanese statements about Taiwan. This is no small matter, since Takaichi has made clear that she will steer Japan's defense spending upward, with the obvious intent to work with the U.S. in containing China. The U.S. has contributed to the charged situation by announcing the Trump administration's first arms sales to Taiwan in Trump's second term, a $330 million sale of parts for fighter jets and other aircraft. China responded angrily to that as well. Prime Minister Takaichi is well aware of Japan's close economic ties to China, and Japanese businesses have urged a quick resolution of the situation. We may expect that Takaichi will not say anything more on the subject, unless, that is, Beijing persists in its criticism. So far, Beijing is persisting. China has warned its citizens not to travel to Japan. Its foreign ministry has summoned the Japanese ambassador for the first time in 2 years, most likely for a dressing down, and Beijing has informed Tokyo that it has stopped buying Japanese fish. Japan, in turn, has urged its citizens to be careful when in China and avoid suspicious people. What's interesting here is that quite a number of well-to-do Chinese, as well as some who are politically liberal, are moving to Japan. They are using an underground banking system to move their money. And, as a Japanese writer points out in a new book, there are 5 Chinese language bookstores that have opened in Tokyo, a pretty good sign of the increasing Chinese population. The U.S. peace plan for Gaza leaves Palestinians on the outside. The United Nations Security Council has endorsed the Trump plan for Gaza, with Russia and China abstaining when it became apparent that the Arab states would support it. However, as reported by CNN, an unofficial part of the U.S. plan calls for the Gaza Strip to be divided north to south into red and green zones. The red zone, bordering the Mediterranean on the west, will be left to the Palestinians. It will not be reconstructed, at least not right away. The green zone bordering Israel and including the West Bank will undergo reconstruction. If this becomes the formal plan, it is a recipe not just for the continuing impoverishment of the Palestinian people, but also for the re-emergence of Hamas or some other militant group dedicated to resuming the resistance. This news is just one piece of the overall dismal prospects for Palestinians. Another piece is the continuing shortage of humanitarian assistance entering Gaza. Israel is breaching international law by continuing to impose restrictions on aid flows into Gaza, where the population remains critically short of food and life-saving goods as winter sets in, a senior official at the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has said. That official points out that the agency has enough food, tents, and other essentials to fill the equivalent of up to 6,000 trucks. But, quote, "As winter approaches and famine continues to grip the population, it is critical that all this aid is allowed into Gaza without delay. Our supplies would be able to provide food for the entire population for about 3 months. And that is sitting outside in Jordan and Egypt, not able to come in. And that is the case for the other UN agencies because the restrictions and the constraints are still there." A third piece in the problem is the mounting settler attacks in the West Bank, which the Israeli far right clearly supports. These attacks, as I've reported before, are leading to seizure of Palestinian lands and burning of their property. Let's remember that the West Bank occupation is not part of the Trump peace plan. The fourth piece is the resumption of Hamas activity. Now Hamas is formally rejecting the U.S. idea of being disarmed under the authority of an international stabilization force. Hamas says it will only disarm with the United Nations directly in charge. In a statement, Hamas said it rejects any agreement that harms, quote, the Palestinian people's right to resistance, which would be an attempt to subject the Gaza Strip to international authority and therefore a violation of Palestinian sovereignty. Next, the Saudi leader visits Trump. Normalization with Israel is out, but business deals are in. Mohammed bin Salman's visit to Washington has at least four consequences. One is moving along a $62 billion high-end housing and tourist development project in which the Trump Organization seems destined to invest. Just another corrupt real estate deal for Trump. A second outcome from MBS's visit, as reported by Haaretz and confirmed in some U.S. press reports, is that Saudi officials have signaled that their country will condition normalization with Israel on a clear diplomatic proposal to establish a Palestinian state. Israel can't dictate diplomatic conditions in a country like Saudi Arabia, one official said. Saudi Arabia issued a strong condemnation and denunciation, that's in quotes, of Israel violence against Palestinians in the West Bank. Prime Minister Netanyahu has promised to contain the violence, but once again he made clear that he opposes a Palestinian state. The Saudis are therefore essentially saying that their country won't normalize relations with Israel while Netanyahu is in power. That view may account for the third consequence, Trump's decision to sell Saudi Arabia F-35 stealth fighter jets, despite alarm reportedly being expressed not only by Israeli defense officials, but also by some in the Pentagon, who worry about China's theft of F-35 technology. Now the Israelis want compensation for this enhancement of the Saudis' military capability. The fourth consequence of the visit is that the major U.S. corporations, led by Elon Musk and other leaders of data collection and AI, will flock in ever greater numbers to Saudi Arabia. All of them were at the gala dinner Trump threw for MBS, his murderous past no longer a barrier to doing business. In other news, Israel continues to interfere in Lebanon. Haaretz reports that a survey conducted last month by the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, the peacekeeping force there, found that a wall built by the Israeli Defense Forces crosses the blue line, the de facto border between the two countries. A spokesperson for the UN Secretary General said the concrete wall has made nearly an acre of Lebanese territory inaccessible to the local population. Beirut said it would complain to the United Nations Security Council. The Russians are advancing in eastern Ukraine and recruiting heavily from Africa. Russian forces are on the verge of capturing Pokrovsk, the first major Ukraine city to fall since Bakhmut in May 2023. For Ukraine's government, the Russian advance poses a difficult choice: defend the city to the last to increase Russian casualties, or pull back to save lives. Military strategists are urging Ukraine to choose the latter, noting that past efforts to defend small cities had resulted in unacceptable casualties. Whereas Ukraine has a dwindling pool of recruits, Russia is extending the list of countries that provide mercenaries, particularly from Cameroon, Ghana, Senegal, and Uganda. In all, according to Ukraine's foreign ministry, 1,400 recruits from 36 countries, and that's apart from the roughly 15,000 North Koreans fighting in Ukraine. A specialist on a PBS program November 13th said, quote, "The African recruits and other internationals are helping Russia increase its battlefield numbers. But that's not just a problem for Ukraine. They're leaving their homelands in such high numbers, particularly in some countries in Africa, that it's becoming a security issue there. So many troops from Cameroon, for instance, have joined up that the Cameroonian Defense Ministry ordered its officers to, quote, immediately take appropriate measures against desertion. All men in uniform are now banned from traveling abroad without special permission," unquote. These mercenaries are promised big salaries and duties far from the front lines, but in fact, they are thrust into frontline battle with resulting high casualties or capture. The civil war between the Sudanese government and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces has again engulfed the country. The RSF's attacks and kidnappings have left hundreds of children homeless and many more wounded or raped. Press reports describe the crisis as historic. U.S. officials estimated last year that 150,000 people had been killed and 12 million people have been displaced. Darfur right now is the epicenter of human suffering on the planet. Mass executions, huge amounts of sexual violence, famine, said UN Humanitarian Chief Tom Fletcher. In a remark directed at the Trump administration, Fletcher said, quote, "I challenge anyone who is boasting about aid cuts to come here and speak to these people." Ecuador's violence is worsening, but U.S. troops won't be deployed there. Ecuador is the most violent, drug-ridden country in Latin America, posing, as in several other countries such as El Salvador and the Philippines, a difficult choice for the leader: rely on maximum force to solve the problem, or take steps to deal with the problem as one rooted in economic and social development. Despite demobilization of the revolutionary FARC force in 2016, Colombia remains a major cocaine-producing state, and its political leaders simply cannot contain it. The gangs involved in the cocaine trade run rampant through the villages. As a result, according to one Ecuadorian writer, quote, "homicide rates, which stood at 7.7 per 100,000 people in 2020, have ballooned to a projected 50 per 100,000 people this year, the highest in Latin America." President Daniel Noboa has made clear that he prefers using force to examining development options. He spent a good deal of time wooing Donald Trump with the idea of establishing a U.S. base in Ecuador to help him fight the drug trade. Secretary of State Marco Rubio committed $20 million in security aid for Ecuador. A foreign base on Ecuadorian soil would require a constitutional amendment, however. The issue was put before Ecuadorians Sunday, and they rejected the idea overwhelmingly. That puts President Noboa in a bind. His approach to improving security seems to have lost favor. As an Ecuadorian researcher for the International Crisis Group said, quote, "The honeymoon period has ended. The public is no longer giving Noboa that space or trust. Now people want to see change and results. The narrative of needing more time is no longer resonating." International student enrollment in the U.S. drops dramatically. Trump administration policies on international education have aimed at limiting the number of international students coming to the U.S. Visa restrictions, outright limitations on how many international students a university may have, and a political test for entry. "They must respect our laws, values, and national interests," says a Department of Education spokesperson. All those things have had the desired effect. New student enrollments declined by 17% in the past year, though the total number of international students in the U.S. declined by only 1%. However, international educators consider the drop very significant. The chief executive of FAFSA, the Association of International Educators, estimates that the loss of new foreign students cost the U.S. nearly $1.1 billion and 23,000 jobs. "The pipeline of global talent in the U.S. is in a precarious position," she said. "The United States must adopt more proactive policies to attract and retain the world's best and brightest." Echoing that view, Chris Glass, a Boston College professor and researcher on international higher education, said, quote, "International students aren't just tuition revenue. A decline in international students is not just a matter for next year's enrollment cycle for universities. It's a strategic setback for America's role as a hub of global talent, science, and innovation." In closing, I want to go back to the Saudi prince's visit to Washington. The president of the United States made a remark that cannot be ignored. A reporter had the temerity to ask him about relations with the prince in light of the prince's responsibility, as determined by the CIA, among others, for the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Here is Trump's reply, quote, "A lot of people didn't like that gentleman that you're talking about. Whether you like him or didn't like him, things happen. But the prince knew nothing about it, and we can have it at that. You don't have to embarrass our guest by asking a question like that," unquote. I wonder what Trump would say if someone explained Charlie Kirk's assassination as "things happened," or that things happened when Trump himself escaped an attempted assassination. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.